Hello everyone, I'm Dalkara Martig and you're listening to the Pet Crafting Podcast. This podcast is a celebration of the growing pet crafting scene and the joys that this sport brings to our lives. In season one, I'll be connecting with pet crafters from diverse backgrounds, including some of the pioneers of modern day pet crafting, and sharing their pet crafting histories, adventure recounts, and musings on life. I'd like to give a big shout out to Alpaca Raft for coming on board as the main sponsor of this podcast. We can thank them for the explosion of modern day pet crafting. My personal pet craft of choice is an Alpaca Raft, and they've taken me on some of the most memorable adventures I've ever had. From snowstorms in Arctic Alaska, to paddling with crocodiles in the baking sun in Western Australia, to exploring my backyard here in New Zealand. Alpaca Raft has been handcrafting pet crafts for 20 years and has spearheaded pet crafting into its modern, more accessible era. All of their boats are made to order in Mancos, Colorado. Whether you're looking for the perfect whitewater pet craft, an ultralight option for bike rafting or backpacking, or the ultimate do-everything backcountry adventure tool, Alpaca Raft has a pet craft for you. Find out more at their website, alpacaraft.com. In this episode, I'm chatting to Willem van Doorn, a pet crafter from Belgium. He's someone who represents the alpaca ethos perfectly, with a passion for exploration combined with a deep connection to and respect for the land. I met Willem in New Zealand 6 years ago during his traverse of the South Island. Three of us who had never met before arranged to meet at Crooked Spur Hut in the Two Thumbs Range. It was back in the days when pet crafting in New Zealand was the tiniest community and we had to work really hard to seek other pet crafters out. Willem is a lovely guy with an enthusiastic thirst for exploration. Something that has always stuck out to me is his methodical way of planning trips, often involving several months or even years of research. He has completed some incredible human-powered trips around the world, and in 2016, he was the recipient of the Golden Paddle Award from the American Pet Crafting Association. In this episode, we talk about his signature trip style, including how he plans his trips and what it is he enjoys most about long journeys. We chat about some of his earlier trips in Scandinavia, adventures in Greenland, a pet craft assisted traverse of the South Island of New Zealand, and a near-death experience during a four-month traverse of Norway. Willem's journeys have been a huge inspiration for many pet crafters from Belgium and around the world. This has also had some unintended consequences, which have been hard for Willem to come to terms with, and we chat about those in the episode as well.
You know, I had like this kind of classic childhood and early teenage years, like for a Belgian. So we pretty much always went to France on a holiday with my parents, like every Belgian, basically. It was kind of this classic holidays, like mostly day hikes from a small house or a cottage that we rented. And the idea back then was to like gradually build up from the hills towards like the higher alpine places like the Alps and the Pyrenees. Throughout the years, and yeah, while me and my sister, like when we grew older, but when I was 13, my father, he got a pretty bad burnout, and our life kind of changed that year. So we bought a small cottage in Belgium on the countryside, and you know, he had some animals, like some cattle and some sheep, and yeah, you know, as soon as you get animals, you're condemned to stay home most of the time. So that was basically the end of our family holidays. And yeah, it's true, by the time I was 18, I hadn't seen any proper mountain or I hadn't slept in a tent. So it's kind of a typical start.
So, and how did you, what sort of triggered your first experience or your your curiosity for being outside then?
Yeah, so I was kind of lucky, in fact. It's when I was 18, there's like at the University of Antwerp, which is Belgium's second largest city. There's a professor there, a biology professor, and he used to organize trips to Svalbard, which is, it's 79 degrees north. He organized trips there every year for his students. And he was kind of a legend in Belgium, this guy. He had crossed the Greenlandic ice sheet and he had done, I think, 30 kind of crazy Arctic expeditions. And so he was going there with 14 students, and I was lucky enough to be one of them. And we were doing like some trek with a tent from location to location, doing some quite straightforward scientific experiments on the way. And, you know, that was an impressive entry to this Arctic world, because we had horrible conditions all the way, like rain and freezing temperatures, pretty much the worst weather. Yeah, the worst weather you can get. And it was, the terrain is quite difficult there. There's a lot of peat. And I remember one of the other guys just losing his boots in the peat. So, you know, it was kind of a miserable trip. And many of us, and including myself, you know, we had a rough trip, really. I was unprepared for it at the time. And, you know, it's kind of nuts when you look back. This professor is taking like 14 absolutely dirtbag 18-year-old students with zero experience through this backcountry full of polar bears. And for me, that was a start. I had a hard time there, but I was so thankful I was able to make this trip, and it kind of started everything else. That was really the start for me.
That's super cool. It reminds me, I think Roman Dial this summer was meant to be, or sometimes takes groups of students on science trips in Arctic Alaska. The same kind of situation, maybe. No polar bears, though.
Yeah, but it's so cool, you know. It's not a standard thing to do. It's a lot of responsibility, but for many young people who are able to do that, it can be something really meaningful in their life. So it's cool. And that was, for me, that was the start of it.
And what degree, you were at university then, what were you actually studying?
Geology. So I studied geology.
Cool. And then in your early adult years, did you live in, was your work situation quite typical, like a Monday to Friday job in an office, or were you doing stuff in the field?
So I was, my first few years working was as a geophysicist. It was a company actually searching for unexploded bombs from the World Wars, and there's quite a lot of them in Europe from the First and the Second World War. And we also had some missions like in Vietnam and Indonesia. So I was abroad sometimes a few weeks, but it was kind of an adventure, but in a totally different way. It was mostly just work and seeing some places, but kind of a standard job. Yeah.
And I guess that sort of sets a really good foundation for longer outdoor journeys, though, because you have all of the logistics and the packing and you're kind of out in nature and sort of challenging environments.
Yeah, you know, we were mostly, we were just sleeping in hotels. It was not the real adventure. So no, just really the packing and everything. It just came with experience just on this. First was like the backpacking treks just on foot, and then later the pack rafting was added to it. But I learned that like myself throughout the years.
Yeah. And if you were to kind of explain or describe that your personal trip style now, or your very favorite way of experiencing nature and the outdoors, what would it be? What would it involve?
For me, like the ultimate trail for me is like going through this pretty much unexplored areas where you have like very, very little information, like Northern Scandinavia, or definitely like Greenland. Alaska would be like this, although I haven't been there. So I try to cross like vast areas of wilderness with kind of long periods in autonomy. I really make it some, I don't like to call it an expedition, but like an exploration trip where you visit areas where little people have been, and try to climb this mountain top, which looks really promising. But the adventure is not really in the adrenaline part for me, but mostly in like the the exploration and the unknowns which are involved in the trip planning and the trip itself.
And where does your inspiration often come from? Because you've done some incredible trips. Do you read stories from other people, or do you look at maps, or?
I read some stories, of course. Often it's like just one or two pictures which can trigger you for an area. So that was the case the first time I went to Greenland. And then I spent too much time on Google Earth, I think. Browsing through the satellite pictures, and you can really like pick areas which look truly interesting also from a backcrafting perspective. And then I start digging a bit deeper in these areas, and that's often the start of it. Like the second Greenland trip I did, that was like purely based on sat pictures. I had no information whatsoever. So I really picked this area based on the satellite pictures.
Yeah, I remember reading a blog of yours once. It might have been a few years ago. It was about how you use Google Earth and the gradient of rivers to plan your journey.
It really makes
me laugh, because it's the total opposite way to, you know, I just don't do any planning like that, but you're so incredible at it.
Yeah, maybe too much, I don't know. but I think it's also important when you go like in this real backcountry, where there's like no backup, you have to be prepared, for sure.
Totally, yes.
So I like spend, and I like it. I like this planning thing. It's like mentally preparing for the trip, and you look forward to certain spots. Definitely.
Yeah, I guess it means that you can have a whole year of entertainment before you actually head away on the trip.
Yeah, definitely. Sometimes even more. Like this Scandinavia thing was, I think, almost 2 years of planning. Not full time, but a few hours every week. Definitely.
Yeah. So in terms of your longer journeys, I know you've done a couple in Greenland, lots in Northern Europe, New Zealand. And what would be your most memorable trips that kind of stand out for you?
Like the first one is actually not a backcrafting trip, but it definitely stands out. When I was 20, so that was only 2 years after this Svalbard trip across the Pyrenees on foot.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really the start of everything, basically from a personal point of view, because I did all the trip planning myself, so I wasn't following a waymarked route, and it was also the first trip I did solo for at least most of it. So that was kind of the start of planning my trips out all by myself. And then a couple of years later, I did this crossing of Scandinavia. That was like a really long trip, 4 months from south to north through Norway.
That was a hiking trip as well, wasn't it?
That was also backcrafting. It had been done before by a few dozen people, like most Norwegians. But they did it all on foot, and there's like a few rivers and lakes you just can't cross, so they would take motorized transport around that. So I added the backcrafting to that, and it allowed for a much more interesting and varied route, and also entirely self-propelled. So it's not as remote as Greenland in Norway, although there is some pretty wild parts. But it was kind of a hard trip because it was like very long in the first place, 4 months. And the terrain in Norway is just also horribly wet. So I was hiking in with, soaked feet for 4 months. And the first part was almost always in deep snow. So it was really from early spring to the end of autumn, basically just using the short window you have in the Arctic. That was a fantastic trip.
Did you get trench foot? Have you had trench foot before?
No. I'm kind of lucky with my feet. I think. I'm kind of lucky with my feet because I know some people just suffer a lot with it, but I never have problems.
Yeah. So that kind of trip that you did, that was mostly off route, or are there tracks there? I have no idea what it looks like. All I picture like in this... my mind is kind of like Arctic Alaska with a lot of tundra and kind of low lying shrubs.
Like this Scandinavia thing. Well, it's kind of a combination. Some areas are kind of developed for hikers. So there's some areas and national parks with a lot of trails and mountain huts. So I crossed some of these, and then in between there's also like undeveloped parts where, as you say, just off track taiga and tundra hiking with very remote rivers I paddled down. So it's, you know, it's not as wild and remote as Alaska, but yeah, the landscape in some parts, although the mountains are not as high, are a bit similar, I think. Yeah,
Yeah, cool.
and
And in
I've never
terms
been in
of,
Alaska.
you have to come to Alaska sometime.
Yeah, no, I know, I want to, I want to.
It will be there. It will be waiting for you.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's cool.
You won't know where to begin, though. There's too many
Yeah,
options.
it's too much. Yeah, I'd love to do the Brooks Range one day, but yeah, you know.
Yeah. Different priorities, hey?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, it's interesting to me. It seems like, from what I can tell, most years you do a kind of a more substantial trip that's been your routine for the life for most of your adult life. Is that right?
Yeah, basically, yeah. Yeah, not every year, but yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Is that sort of because you like the longer journeys, or is it as a result of where you're living, or what is it? Seems like quite an intentional or conscious decision to do that, from my perspective.
Yeah, of course. You know, I think it's interesting you say that. It's a bit the combination of both, I think. Yeah, I live in Belgium, which is like super flat. There's, yeah, just from a wilderness or mountain perspective, we have yeah, basically nothing in Belgium. So you're very consciously planning your trips. You're really looking forward to the time you will be able to spend out in the wilderness. So yeah, I think that is one factor for sure. Yeah, and then the second thing, yeah, I like those long trips because it's like totally different mindsets than a short trip. Like in a short trip, you're somehow still connected. And on a long trip, yeah, it's a totally different kind of trail you have there with a, yeah, a lot of uncertainties on the way. And it's also like very humbling to be out there, definitely when you're soloing. It's like it's just on this very long trips that for me, like life kind of spins down to its essence, where you have nothing else to think about. And that's just an incredible feeling, and which I'm very privileged to, yeah, to have experienced a couple of times. And it's, yeah, it's kind of an addictive feeling.
It is totally addictive,
Yeah, definitely. So,
What kind of, I've talked to quite a few people about the
yeah.
optimum length trip. For you, what kind, when you talk about a short trip versus a long trip, what is the difference? Is there a set time that you kind of consider really extra worthwhile for being outdoors?
You know, it's your mind kind of adapts to the length of trip you have, I think. So the longest I've done is 4 months. And just at the start of the trip, your mind is already adapting to the length of the trip you will have. But I would say to just, I don't, yeah, experience this feeling of life, like I said, life spinning down to its essence, and everything else becomes like yeah, trivial. I would say 3 or 4 weeks for me is the minimum. But I think that's very personal.
Yeah, interesting. And have you, when you finish those trips and go back to the city, does it take you quite a while to adjust back into your like urban life?
Actually, no. It's, you know, definitely when you've been soloing, it's you're happy to see your friends and family again, and I'm very happy to have a beer on the first evening I come back to. I have a little problem with that. I think on these long trips, the trip is also like winding down, I think, also mentally the last week, and you're actually already preparing to get back home. And when you get there, you're just happy to be back home. It's always good to be home as well.
Yeah, totally. It's interesting. Have you been based in Ghent? How do I pronounce it? The city you're
Yeah,
from?
Ghent.
Ghent,
Ghent is right. Yeah.
Have you been based in Ghent for most of your adult life?
Yeah, all of it actually. I was born there. You know, I've moved a couple of times. It was always, yeah, within the city walls, you could say. So yeah, it's really my hometown. Yeah, it's a very nice town, by the way, like medieval and a lot of nice bars. And you know, all my friends and family are here, so it's kind of logic to stay.
So at the moment, what is your day to, well, maybe not this year. This year is a bit different for most people, but what is your typical, your day-to-day life in the city like? What is your kind of work situation and routine?
So yeah, a couple of years ago, I switched from this geophysical just 9-to-5 job. Now I have my own guiding company, so we're offering some trips to Norway, to the Arctic, to Greenland, also in winter. So my life has kind of changed. I'm much more flexible now, but still, I would, you know, it's a lot of administration. So still, most of my days I will spend behind the computer doing all the administration for the trips, and I hope to be out in the wilderness 8 to 10 weeks a year, I would say. And in the evening, I just this year is different, of course, but meet up with some friends and have a beer, and you know, kind of a standard life, I think, when I'm back home.
Yeah. It always fascinates me, especially with people who are very adventurous, just the contrast between their day-to-day life and their adventure life. Sometimes they're almost inseparable, and sometimes they're quite different.
Yeah. I think for you it's been different, right? When you were like in Alaska and...
Yeah, different. And I think New Zealand is quite different because it's actually really hard to get geographically remote here, but it's very easy to get to a rugged place from any city. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So... It just changes people's relationship with the outdoors because it's accessible on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Like here, I have this race bike, and I'm happy to get out of the city in the evening when it's nice weather, but just to do a long tour. But it's different. You're still in civilization. It's not this outdoor experience you can get in New Zealand or even when you live in the Alps. It's not like escaping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. And in terms of your guided trips, was that... So you've been offering... I mean, they're quite adventurous trips from what I can see. They're kind of small group, almost expedition or journey style boutique adventures. Is that right?
Yeah, so it's mostly... It's group travel, so always like 7 or 8 people. It's just the kind of things I like to do myself. I try to offer it to people to get the same experience in the wilderness. So it's not super hardcore, of course, but it's kind of tough trips in winter with a bulk on skis. And also we have some trips in Greenland, which are through remote areas, sleeping in tents. So it's just my own lifestyle. I try to copy a bit there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And are those people often the kinds of people who would be excited to go independently but don't quite have the skills or don't know where to start, or are they?
I think it's like one group is people who maybe just once want to have this wilderness experience, but they don't have the experience to plan it themselves. What we also do, like both for this winter trips and the Greenland trips, it's kind of the kind of trips where you need a lot of gear or where the logistics would be extremely expensive if you just do it on your own. So where you have like a real advantage of coming with a group and with the people who have experience in the area where it's just hard to do it yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. Yeah, I've had in the back of my mind, if I want to do a trip in Greenland, I thought, oh, I can contact Willem and see if I can help organize a food drop.
just give me a shout out. We can talk about it, definitely.
Yeah. Have you had any interesting experiences with polar bears anytime?
No. Actually not. No. So, and I'm happy I don't have it. So neither in Svalbard, neither in Greenland, I've never seen one actually. I've been carrying a gun on many trips, but I've never seen one. So which is good, you know. I would like to see one from a boat, but maybe not on a trip like this.
I think that's the thing I'm most terrified of, actually. You know, a good friend of mine did the first she sea kayaked around Svalbard, circumnavigated it.
It's Tara Mulvaney, or...
Yeah, Tara Mulvaney, Stanley's daughter, And they had days where they were chased by polar bears, and it just sounded amazing and terrifying at the same time.
No, I wouldn't like that.
Yeah.
I don't know, it's one of the things, even in Alaska, it's not polar bears, but grizzly, I'm a little bit afraid of that. I've never been like in bear country, like in Alaska. So it's something which still terrifies me a bit.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty cool. It, it sort of feels very human, you know. It changes the whole way that you look at the rat land around you, and the fact that you're now at the top of the food chain, it can feel quite...
Yeah, it's interesting.
That's cool. And it sounds like you've got some ideas for Patagonia someday.
Yeah, you know, there's dreams. Always these trips. Yeah, dreams, I would say now. There's always these trips you are planning, and, you know, there's like these huge wilderness areas around the globe. It's, Patagonia is definitely one of them. And there are so much things which are like totally unexplored there, definitely in the Southwest and along the West Coast. I have like this one really big trip I'm dreaming of. The plan is ready on the shelf, you know. I just need the time to do it. It's with a lot of uncharted terrain there's a lot of open water there. And it's kind of funny because I listened to Forrest McCarthy's first episode of the podcast, and he basically said it's nuts to do it. But, you know, if you have some time and you're willing to sit out a lot of bad weather, I think it must be possible. And it's definitely
totally. Nice. That depends on the context too, you know, your background. You've got a lot of experience with good judgment.
You just need a lot of time to sit out the bad weather, and you need to want to do that, and then it's possible, I think. But it would be like a really hard trip with a lot of open water and horrible terrain. It's like rainforests. It's just very hard to penetrate. But it's definitely on my list. Maybe not in the coming 2 or 3 years, but I want to make it there before I'm 40. That's my plan now.
It sounds pretty funny. That's a lot of people, that would be their trip from hell. Lots of storms to wait out, lots of open water, lots of bush bashing.
I'm not saying it will be fun all the time, but it's just a fascinating area.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many things there which are really unexplored, where no one has ever been, I think. And it attracts me a lot just to give it a try, and we'll see if it works, maybe not. But,
yeah, totally. That's exciting. And interesting politics, kind of organizing permits and things like that in certain areas, I've heard.
Yeah, that's a hard thing. And you also need, you know, you've got like the border between Chile and Argentina. You need to cross it a few times, and that's also, a hard thing, because you just can't just cross it in the wilderness. But there's a lot of things to sort out, but we'll see, maybe one day.
Yeah. And is it, you know, all of these trips you do are mostly solo. Is that a conscious decision, or what is it that you love about being solo?
I've been out there solo for like 6-7 weeks without seeing like anyone, so that's not kind of standard. But I think I'm not some kind of a weirdo.
You're not sick of your girlfriend?
Yeah, I don't know. It's also difficult to get the time. Yeah, it's true. But, you know, I do a lot of my trips with friends and other people and I guide groups, and I enjoy that a lot, you know, like really a lot, and just sharing those experiences and going through it together. But, you know, like on a solo trip, somehow it's like the emotions are much more easy to recall afterwards. They're like stronger. The feeling you get in the wilderness sometimes is like more, I would say it's like a more primitive feeling. It's really back to basics. And just being out there on your own, like weeks away from civilization, it's a very impressive feeling. It's a very humbling feeling. Which not too many people have experienced, and for me that's very addictive.
I guess that maybe, do you think it's partly because, you know, if you do a trip with friends, you have other people are influencing your thought patterns or discussions, but on your own you're only being influenced by your own mind and the nature and the world around you?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, people like influencing your thought, it's not a bad thing, you know, but you are just thinking in a totally different way. That's true. And you're like assessing the risks all the time. It's like, you're really out there. Like, I don't know, maybe as we were out there as humans long time ago, like just experiencing the trail and the trail of wandering through this like unknown territory and like accepting the dangers. And that's like a very rich experience for me. It makes me feel like very complete. Maybe it's easy to say. It's easy to say maybe when you have just all your food freeze-dried in your backpack, but you know, it's a primitive feeling, and that's very rewarding.
Yeah, and on the food topic, you go on really long trips, so some of them you obviously have food resupplies, but what's the longest amount of time you've carried your food on your back for?
I think that must have been on this Greenland trip in 2016. It must have been 20 days.
Wow.
20 days of food.
That's a lot. Yeah.
It's a lot. And I eat a lot.
That's
I don't want to be hungry. I don't want to lose weight. I also don't want to be hungry. I want to eat what I want on those trips because you don't want this mental strain of being hungry.
Yeah.
So it's 20 kilos of food. Yeah.
I still think, you know, I remember in New Zealand when we met in that hut, I remember looking at your backpack and it was so embarrassing for me. There's a photo of both of us with our backpacks and mine must be twice the size of yours.
Yeah, you had quite a big backpack. That's true. But you know, you had all this backcrafting gear, I remember. You floated down the Cass River afterwards,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. But your bag, your packing systems are just completely dialed. Do you weigh lots of things? Are you one of those people who's really geeky with all of the weights of all of your gear?
Yeah, I used to. Like a couple of years ago, everything. Now I'm like a little bit more relaxed on it. And, you know, I will take some comfort things because it's also nice on those trips to have some items which are like not totally necessary, but just having them gives you some kind of, you know, you just feel better.
Definitely.
But yeah, definitely. I'm very conscious on what I take, of course, and you have to if you're carrying 20 kilos of food, you have to save some elsewhere.
And you know, you've written heaps of amazing stories and take really great photos of your trips. I found it quite interesting just seeing the evolution of that. Well, I talked to Forrest and Stanley about it because it obviously gets quite controversial with how you share things and just the online space. How have you felt about that in the last decade, really? Just your personal experience?
Just with sharing things on my blog?
What has motivated you to share your journeys in the way that you have?
You know, at first, I think there was just some personal account of things. You know, I never thought people would actually read it. So at first started as a personal account, and then I started noticing that people read it, and definitely for this long Scandinavia trip I wrote kind of an extensive report, and some people used it. But now recently in the last 2-3 years I've been like more inactive, and there's a couple of reasons for that. The first, I just have a little bit less time and I haven't felt like writing that much last few years. But you know, it's also, as you say, it's some things are like controversial. There's been last year, and that has impacted me quite a bit. There's been 2 deadly accidents with Belgian pack rafters. So just over the span of 2 or 3 weeks, I think one was on a lake in Iceland, and then there was like a very young guy, and he drowned in a river in British Columbia just after putting in. They were both soloing, and I know that at least one of them, had been reading my blog, and you know, I don't know if I was like some kind of an inspiration for them. It doesn't matter, but you know, I've really struggled with this because you know they were using my blog and they put themselves into danger and died, you know, and that's incredibly depressing to think of. So that definitely has demotivated me a bit to ride on the trips.
That's interesting. Hey, that's really tough. It's inevitable to feel that kind of connection and responsibility, but I mean, sharing has also been something humans have done for a long, long time. It's sort of part of our culture and our social fabric.
Yeah, of course. But yeah, you know, it's just, it gets like very close to you at that time because, you know, they've been reading your stuff and I don't know, it has been, I felt super bad about it in some way.
How has that impacted the packrafting community in Belgium? I mean, Belgium, it must be a reasonably small community, I'm assuming.
Yeah, although there's quite a lot of people paddling here, although we don't have that many interesting rivers, but I think there must be, at least a few hundred, maybe 1,000 pack rafters in Belgium now, so that's quite a
Wow.
lot.
Yeah.
I don't know really. It's Luc Mille who published this on his
Yeah.
pack raft fatality list, which is, it's really good. He does that, by the way.
Yeah, I'm going to talk to him about that in an episode soon, actually.
All right. Okay. Cool. That should be interesting. Yeah, that should be interesting. I don't know if there's not too many of these few hundred or thousand people in Belgium who like do this kind of remote trips. So I don't know if it had like a lot of impact in the general community.
Yeah, that's tough. I'm sorry, hey.
Yeah.
It's
Yeah.
always
Yeah.
tricky.
Yeah.
You can
Yeah.
always feel some kind of guilt, and it takes the time to process it.
Yeah, definitely. So for the blog, it's what has also been like having a large impact is, just the impact those write-ups have on the wilderness itself. Because of course, there's been the social media and definitely Instagram, which have had a huge impact over the last 5 or 10 years. And just as an example, in my Greenland trip in 2013. Until that time, I put a map with all the details of all my routes online, always at the end of my report. So you could just basically follow my tracks and do it yourself. And on this trip, there was one other Belgian guy called Yuri Terijen. He was one of my main inspirations to start pack rafting, by the way. He had been in South Greenland in 2009, without a pack raft. So I followed a few parts of his route. But then I had a pack raft, so I extended it a lot, all the way from Narsarsuaq to the Noordtallik with a lot of fjord crossings on the way. So that was a fantastic route. But there was like this one absolutely insane spot he had been to. He really discovered it. So all credits to him for that. And it's one of those spots I really wanted to visit. And after 3 weeks after setting off from Narsarsuaq, I eventually got there. And the views from that spot, it's like 700 meters above the fjords. They're absolutely insane. It's like a phenomenal view through a series of iceberg dotted fjords and sea straits. And they're like lined by these glacier capped mountains, which pretty much rise 2 kilometers from the fjords vertically. So it's absolutely science fiction. It's been the most spectacular spot I've been to. I put a lot of details on this location on my blog, and Yuri put it on his blog. And I think it was like 2 or 3 years later that we noticed that there was a few commercial photographers who started including it into their tours in South Greenland, but as a day trip with boat transport. So that is when we started taking the details offline. But it was too late, and you saw this very spot appearing on Instagram more and more. And a couple of weeks ago, and that was like really painful. I saw an ad on Facebook where there's this large luxury cruise expedition company, and they drop tourists there on this very spot by helicopter.
Wow. Oh,
And my
that's
heart
such a
is,
bummer.
I don't want to deny those people to see this beauty, but just a spot evolving from like total wilderness into some kind of Disneyland in 10 years. You're like directly responsible for that. And that's just my heart is bleeding when I think about that. So
It's fascinating, Willem. I think it's the time we live in. I have similar stories, and I've stopped really sharing as well. But it's the natural evolution of technology. No one really realized how fast things would travel and how popular things would become.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's just So now I'm like more careful, and I never publish like a map with all of my routes. I will never publish a GPX track, just to avoid this kind of stuff, or try to avoid it just for myself. And maybe it's just also dangerous to have like too much information online, because people who are actually unprepared for a trip in such a remote backcountry could just try to follow your track while they're actually not prepared for it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, doing the trip planning and building up really slowly provides you with the scaffolding needed to sort of
definitely.
Be safe.
Yeah, definitely.
I get the feeling that you've always been quite a safe person with really good decision making. I don't know why. I think it's just the vibe you give. But have you ever had any kind of scary experiences in the outdoors on...
Like during the pack crafting or like in general?
It doesn't need to be. We don't have to just talk about pack crafting. It can be anything.
All right. I've come close to that once on a trip. And that was while I was doing this 4 months crossing in Norway. I was just like... Yeah, one of these typical miserable cold and rainy days in Scandinavia. So so I was heading for a small cabin, which I knew was there on my track. And when I eventually got there, there was like a small stove. And of course, I wanted to light it to dry some clothes and get a bit warmer. But it was like this kind of rusty old stove, and there were even some holes in the side panel. So, you know, I was very aware that there was like some risk of carbon monoxide poisoning. But, you know, I was soaked to the skin, basically. So I just opened the door a bit so there was some ventilation and put it on anyway. And, you know, every day on this trip, I recorded like a diary on my mobile phone just through a voice clip. And it was about an hour later and I was doing this. And just while doing this, you know, I just felt that my thinking was so slow and I just... couldn't recall things which just happened a few hours ago. So then I realized something was like seriously wrong, like seriously wrong. Totally wrong. So I walked to the door to get some fresh air and I really fainted in the doorway right at the time I opened it.
Wow, that's crazy.
That's super close, and it's not a spectacular story, but that's kind of the dangers that is people don't think about in the outdoors, but it's also in all these backcountry huts in New Zealand and stuff, you got to watch out. It's like, if I hadn't been recording this diary, I'm pretty sure I would have died there. I would never have realized and I would have fainted inside and died. So that was super close.
Wow, that's incredible. Hey, it's unusual to actually pick that up. You're kind of picking up the difference in your cognitive ability.
Yeah, you know, they always say it's like the silent killer, the carbon monoxide, but it's true. I never felt anything, no headache, nothing. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you're in your early 30s now, right? I think you're a tiny bit older than me. Since you were kind of in the last decade, has your motivation for being outside and your drive changed, or has it kind of remained quite similar?
You know, of course, as I told you, I discovered this like when I was 18, 20 years old. And then I was like super enthusiastic and just planning trips all the time. That is maybe a little bit less now. Now I'm like more planning to this big adventures and the smaller trips in between. You know, I still look forward to them a lot, but I'm not like this planning fury and stuff. I just cooled down a little bit, but I try to be out as much as I can, and it's still defining my life, and it always will.
Your girlfriend must be very patient, as she's you sometimes do some trips with her, right? But you've often
of course most of the trips we do together, and then every now and then she knows I need to do this solo thing, but she's okay with it.
It's awesome.
Not every year, you know. It's just every few years I try to do a bigger trip. So it's a nice balance, I think.
And most people who have that motivation or those itchy feet, if you took that away from them completely, you wouldn't be the person you are, and your partner loves you for that too.
I wouldn't be happy. No, true, definitely. No, I need it, definitely.
Yeah. Another thing I was going to ask you is, because to me, I'm just so fascinated by the fact that you live in a city. Do you find it very challenging sometimes, or is it you're just so used to it because that's how you grew up?
I grew up here, and, you know, I like the city as well, like just small events, and, you know, there's just a whole, you know, Belgium is quite known for its cozy bars, and there's a lot of them in Ghent. So I like to just hang out with friends. I really do. So it's also part of my life. And actually, it has a lot of disadvantages, of course, and my outdoor part would be more happy living in an area with more possibilities like you do in New Zealand. But it's also, you know, sometimes I think it's also good, like, to get this physical separation because you really look forward to the trips you want to do. It's not like it always feels like a privilege to get out, more than it would, I
Totally.
think, than if you were living right next to the mountains. So it also balances things. That's also good. So I don't know. Maybe one day I will move to the mountains. It's something I haven't figured out yet, but for now I'm happy as it is.
Yeah. And do you do much training, like in terms of fitness? Do you bike or run or do anything like that? Yeah.
I bike quite a bit. I run a bit, you know, nothing obsessive or, but yeah, I'm in good shape throughout the year.
Yeah, cool. I'm bummed out. I was excited to come and visit you this year. I had it in my schedule.
We have planned, right? Yeah, that's how it goes.
That would have been Dalcara out of her comfort zone in a pub in Belgium.
It would be a strange stop in your in between all the wilderness. It's something different.
Yeah, good chocolate and good food though.
Definitely. No, it's a cool country, but it's a bit different. It's true.
Yeah, do you have anything else you're excited to chat about? I thought it would be kind of nice to get some more details on some of your trips, not the actual routes, but just more insights or.
I don't know, maybe, just how all this packrafting thing started for me.
Yeah,
I
I
don't know.
guess. I mean, did you
You
just
get through the
find
trips
out
a bit.
about packrafting from. Oh, yeah, tell us about your journey with packrafting and how you first got into it.
There was also, I just told you about this guy, this Yuri Tuijen, the guy who went to Greenland and like discovered this crazy spot. But he was the first packrafter in Belgium, basically. He started in 2009, I think. And we talked to each other every few weeks about our outdoor trips. He has done a lot of crazy stuff. And back then, he told me he was going to buy a packraft, and that was like still the old alpaca raft design, like the very primitive one, like more looking like a pool float. So he told me he was going to buy this and go to Sarek, which is, kind of a large national park in northern Sweden, a pretty nice area, to float some rivers and do some new routes there with his packraft. And I remember just thinking, you know, you are like crazy. I'd never heard of a packraft back then, and the idea was just nuts to me, like using this boat to cross like really big wilderness. But in the end, he came back alive to my surprise, and I started looking at the routes he did, and you know, I was starting to see the potential. Then I also started reading into the trips of, of course, like Roman Dahl and Forrest McCarty and Andrew Skurka, who had just finished his Alaska Yukon expedition. I was getting convinced, to start myself. I was already planning on the Scandinavia trip, so it opened a whole lot of possibilities there. And I bought one the year after and started myself.
It's interesting now that it has become more mainstream.
Yeah, back then it was like very few people, and
Yeah,
now it's
it's. I miss it. I miss it being more unusual. There was something quite special about the community being smaller.
yeah, true. Yeah, true. Yeah, now it's more all the brands popping up and a lot of people starting, but it's good. It's good.
Yeah,
It's good to have a big community.
it's interesting. Hey, I remember. In New Zealand, the first time I saw someone else in a packraft, it was on a river near Nelson, and I literally slammed my brakes on the car, pulled over, and ran down to the riverbank and started yelling out at them.
You had a packraft at that time, or?
Yeah, and I was just so excited and so shocked to see somebody, and
That's cool.
it's
At the Pelorus River, or?
no, it was actually just the Motueka River.
All right. Okay.
But I mean, now you see them everywhere here. It's so mainstream. It's really interesting.
It opens so many possibilities.
Yeah, it would be cool. I mean, it would be great to hear a bit more about your New Zealand trip. a funny memory that just pops into my mind is before we met up for that section, I remember you telling me about your adventures with mice.
Oh, yeah. There's so many of them in the huts. Like, I often slept in those backcountry huts, mostly in the standard huts, the six bunkers. We also had a lot of them. I think it's together at Royal Hut. There's so many mice in there. They just walk on your bed and your sleeping bag when you're sleeping. It's I had them inside my sleeping bag, you know. That was at Archer's Pass, I think. Like, I was like, I had a few beers with a few other guys there. I was a little bit drunk, and I think I was inside my sleeping bag for 5 minutes when I realized there were two or three mice there. So, yeah, it was funny.
That's funny. You know, it's unusual. It's because of, the beach forest. It's a beach mass. Every few years you have a mass seeding. So the summer you were there was particularly bad. There normally aren't so many mice.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was funny, actually, in the huts. They were just running everywhere.
Mm-hmm. And did you like the New Zealand, the backcountry hut network?
Yeah, definitely. It's fantastic. There's so many of them. And yeah, like the ones like now at the TRO, I guess it's getting a bit more busy. But like many of those huts, you're just on your own, or there's one or two other guys, and they always have interesting stories and a lot of knowledge of the terrain. So it's a fantastic system. And it's so cheap, you know. I don't know. I paid like this typical tourist backcountry hut pass. I paid, I don't know, $80 for it. You can just stay in as many huts as you want. It's a great system.
Yeah, pretty unique, hey?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so this New Zealand trip in general. Across like the South Island from north to south, but like not following this TRO route, but like doing my own thing. And I tried to stay like a little bit closer to the watersheds at the Southern Alps. So it was a fantastic route. You know, it's sensational backcountry. The weather was great most of the time. It's a good climate. I think it was like the best trip of my life because everything just went so super smooth without any setbacks. And on a 2 month trip, that's kind of exceptional. It was like a holiday from start to finish.
That's crazy, man. The New Zealand weather was so nice to you.
It's fantastic. I had some episodes of rainy weather, but mostly I was like just east of the watershed, and it had a lot of nice weather. And I remember like this part from the Rangitata to Glenorchy. There's like so many valleys which are like very seldom visited. Like the Tasman, the Dobson, I think the Ahuriri, Makaroa, the Dart. I just all connected that by hiking across the mountains and then pedal down the rivers. It's fantastic, unbelievable trip. I think if New Zealand wasn't at like the other side of the world, maybe that's the one place I would just have moved to right after the trip.
Yay! Yeah, it's interesting, hey? It's interesting here because it's quite, you know, you can do lots of amazing trips, but it can be hard to do long trips because you don't have to do long trips. You can do most things in weekends. So we don't we don't have a culture of long trips like some places.
All right. Okay, that's interesting. Yeah. Because there's some areas like definitely in the west and Fjordland where it's kind of remote, right? And you need to be out for a couple of days like Stanley Melvney.
I'm so excited. Yeah. I'm building a house in Tiano in Fjordland.
Yeah, true. Yeah, you told me. It's great. It's fantastic. It's a fantastic starting point for a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, yeah, even if you're not going out sometimes, there's this really peaceful feeling about knowing that there's a place right there that is a large expanse that will always be natural.
Yeah, you're making me jealous. Yeah.
You'll have to come and visit.
Yeah, definitely, I will. Yeah, it's at the other side of the world, so I won't be there every year. But yeah, I would like to come back one day for sure.
I guess you also mentioned in an email to me that you're really interested in doing more conservation work. I'm not sure what you meant specifically. What do you see that looking like in the future? How would you like to weave it in?
Yeah, so... you know, I think there's at the moment, this is like some kind of a general thought maybe, but like across the world, there's like more and more, and which is really good, of course, there's like more and more attention for this whole global warming and green energy evolution, which is absolutely necessary, you know, because, you know, the world is changing at like a terrifying pace. So but I think it also confronts us like with huge paradoxes, because like green energy is also like threatening a lot of wilderness, and like any area you can now think of where you want to go, there's like huge wind farms or hydropower schemes which are planned, and you know, that's a super interesting paradox, I think. And just I remember this Eternity Fjords area in Greenland. I was yeah, they're planning a huge hydropower thing there, just with 200 kilometers of electricity lines right through the wilderness. It's the same in Nepal and India. There's a lot of projects planned, and yeah, it's for me, it's a paradox. And you know, of course, I'm not against this green energy shift. It's absolutely necessary. But yeah, one of the things we really have to think about now is, I think, just to have decent land planning and like concentrate this green energy at certain spots, in order to conserve other spots and keep them for future generations. Because even in a warming climate, all this wilderness will still be incredibly, incredibly valuable. So that is one of the things I would like to spend more time in. It's more like a general topic, not a single project. But it can be a very positive story, I think, because in this whole global warming discussion, the actions you take as an individual or a government to take, it's like very hard to quantify the effects. And that can be like a bit demotivating. When you're just working on this efficient land planning, it can be a super positive story for anyone, and you see the results directly. And as a local activist or group of activists or a local politician, you also have like a direct influence on what the landscape will look like in the future. So I don't know, it's like not totally crystallized in my head, but this is one of the things I would like to spend more time on in the future, maybe in the next phase of my life. I would like to dedicate it to this kind of stuff, because, you know, we're just at the very start of this entire revolution, this green energy revolution. And if we're not careful, it will also ruin a lot of things. So that's, it's interesting to think about.
Yeah, totally. It's interesting, you know, it's quite a common story. Those of us who spend lots of time in these wild places and are connected to them are then the ones that in our older years, you know, middle age, 40s, 50s and 60s, often dedicate that time to preserving them.
So maybe I will be like one of them. But it's a huge challenge which we are facing, and we have to think right now how we want to solve some problems and how we want to preserve a lot of wilderness for the future. Because now it's like a bit, at least in Europe, I don't know how it is in politics in the rest of the world, but in Europe it's kind of a bit of anarchy, and there's a lot of projects planned where we like try to be a bit more Catholic than the Pope himself sometimes. So it's a difficult discussion, because, you know, it's green energy and it's good for the climate, but it can ruin other things as well.
Yeah. Most things are more grey. They're not so black and white, hey?
No, definitely. So, you know, that's maybe the next phase of my life. I would like to spend more time on this kind of topics.
And if we just come back to 2020 this year, have you found this year really challenging? Like, how has it been for you?
You know, for myself, I won't complain. You know, I'm healthy and everyone around me is healthy. I've been quite seriously impacted business-wise, of course. But, you know, it's relative. It's just 1 year. And I think when we will look back at this in the future, it's, you know, it's just a tiny slice of history. So I kind of accept it. And it's just what it is. And we still have a lot of years to come where we will be able to do a lot of fantastic stuff again. So it's just a challenge which comes on the way, but I don't complain.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it.
Yeah, you have to, right?
I waver between feeling like that and just borderline kind of down and anxious. Just sort of, it kind of weighs on your shoulders, even though you know you're in a privileged position.
It sucks sometimes, but it is what it is. And yeah, as you say, we're privileged. We're still privileged, so it's good to good to remember that. And better days will come again.
Definitely. Yeah. Cool. I think I'm pretty much, I've talked about everything I thought I'd chat about with you.
All right.
Do you? Cool. It's been awesome. Of all sorts of different tangents.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for having me. Yeah, for sure.
I hope you enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed chatting to Willem. I think his challenge of balancing city life, being close to friends and family, and quenching his thirst for wild places is something that many packrafters can relate to. And with that, I wish you all a happy new year, sending good vibes around the world from Aotearoa, New Zealand. Hopefully 2021 can have a few more adventures in it. I'll catch you in 4 weeks with the next episode.